This is CliffCentral.com.
In less than 10 minutes, Oprah Winfrey will be in the room. It's 2005, and Oprah was in South Africa for her Live Your Best Life tour. Simply put, Oprah loves the country. Beyond the Oprah Winfrey Leadership Academy for Girls, she has built countless other facilities and given millions in scholarship funds for her schools other than hers. She has acknowledged countless times that Nelson Mandela's impact on her life must be reciprocated by giving back to his native home. So it was in this vein that when she was in SA, as the other countries outside of America she didn't go to. And before she would give her talk on this afternoon, she decided she would meet in a private room next to the conference center one of Nelson Mandela's grandchildren and a couple of her friends. I was one of her friends. There were seven of us. Growing up, I was always respectful of Oprah, but not a big fan. Certainly not one of the screaming ones that went crazy on her show. But I was extremely grateful for this opportunity to meet her, particularly because in 2005, I was finishing my first book, and I thought I could just get some of her literary book genius to rub off. It would be a good start for my writing career. But the question was, what would I say to Oprah? This was at the height of Oprah's celebrity. 7 years before, she would end her historic run as queen of daytime talk show television. In 2005, she was the undisputed queen, a living legend. As I was thinking about what type of conversation I would have with her, someone in the room yelled, 3 minutes, she's in! The six others I was with squealed, and with large eyes, they looked like ghosts. One of the young ladies started visibly shaking, literally trembling. I was trying to play it cool, but my heart also started thumping for some reason. Maybe it's the crowd effect. Just as someone says 1 minute to go, a door flung open, and just like in an opening scene from our TV show, her energy splashes the entire room. She says, "Hello, everyone! Hands high!" The one girl who was shaking uncontrollably walks straight to her, touches her on the shoulder, drops to the floor, faints. I was fourth in line to meet her. Much more hilarity ensued before me, but for the purposes of this podcast, it was my time for a conversation. The 4 to 5 minute chat I had with Oprah would change the course of my life. Welcome back to the Brain and Brand Show. I'm your host, Timothy Maurice, and this is the show where we explore the link between brain and brand behavior, how people impact brands, and how brands impact your brain and ultimately your behavior. Today we'll explore the power of conversation, how mastering conversation can be your ticket to building a network that elevates you closer to your goals and dreams. But this is not just a personal pursuit or professional, it's both. The ability to start and thrive in a healthy conversation is critical to just about every area of your life, from conversing with your neighbor, to drive your community goals, to connecting with others in a bar, in a casual chat, at your work cocktail events. Conversations are a dance we must all learn to do. Today, I've got the privilege, I'll be speaking to one of my mentors and friends, Menard Brown, known by his radio and TV entertainment moniker, Buster Brown. I met Menard in 1995 when he hosted one of the most powerful morning hip-hop shows on the East Coast in America. We met at a mall and became friends due to our mutual interest in inspiring teenagers. Menard has interviewed everyone from Puff Diddy, Daddy, whatever his name is now, to Stevie Wonder, who he later became friends with. What has struck me about Menard is his ability to use the art of conversation to bond with people miraculously so. So in this first episode of the year, while on holiday, while back in the East Coast in America, I thought, let me find out what his secrets are to his conversation mastery. After my chat with Menard, I'll come and tell you a little bit more about what happened with Oprah. Menard Brown, welcome to the Brain and Brand Show.
It's good to be here, man.
You know, it's crazy. It's real. It's wild, actually, to be having this conversation.
The way you introduced me.
You know, it's crazy to be having this conversation with you because literally I've watched you strike up conversations with kids who just learned to talk with the same frequency as I've seen you have conversations with people like Solange. What do you love about conversations?
getting to know people and understanding that we all have these commonalities that in most cases we don't realize we have, and which makes us intimidated of each other, afraid of each other. And once you have an open and honest and raw conversation with someone, it makes you feel better about yourself. Because you think, oh, wow, you too? And then you look at them like, me too. It's a broad.
It's a me too thing,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Were you always good at this me too thing? As a kid, as a teenager,
yeah. What
were you like in conversation?
Well, the reason why I'm good at conversation is when I was 11, I wanted to do this for 11 radio, TV. So I would, interview myself. I was on Oprah. I was on Donahue. I was on Johnny Carson. I was on the big stage interviewing the Jacksons and introducing Stevie Wonder.
As a teenager.
As an 11-year-old.
Wow.
In my mind.
I
right?
know. I'm with you.
So in my dream, I have to talk to people about, how I became so famous. And so as I got older, it became natural.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you literally played it out in your head.
Oh, man.
So
all
much
the
so.
Way.
It became natural.
All the way. Yeah.
So you didn't really have that moment of overcoming it. You had to overcome it first to do it in your head.
Yeah. I mean, the day my sister and mom went to the grocery store, and my sister was in a rush and dropped her brush. So I picked the brush up, got the hair out of the brush, and it became my microphone. And I realized right then, if you can see your dream, you can touch your dream. Yeah.
Let's go back.
Yeah.
I want people to understand, you grew up in an area where at some stage, I remember you telling me a story,
right.
Spike Lee tried to do a documentary there, but somebody got shot the first couple of days and they stopped.
Well, actually, this cat, Kevin, God, I forgot his name. I know him as Peanut, cat I grew up with. He was the one that did the documentary. Spike Lee actually did a documentary on my neighborhood.
In California,
San Francisco, and Hunter's Point. My neighborhood, a neighborhood in Little Rock, and I think the Magnolia in New Orleans. At that time, they were three of the worst neighborhoods, so he did a documentary on it.
And you grew up in this type
in
of
this neighborhood, right?
Wow.
And Peanut actually did the documentary where the cat was shot. During the taping of the documentary. And it was a trip because when the dude was shot, some of the cats got all up in the camera. This is how we do, man. This is how we do. Right? So,
wow.
Yeah, and right then, I remember I was always in a neighborhood like that. I went to all of the schools in my neighborhood. And the one time I went to a school outside of my neighborhood, where it was predominantly, Caucasian kids. Right away, that communication stuff kicked in, and I was only 8. I wanted them to know we're not all like that. The most important skill in communication is the ability to listen. And that's what I did at 8. I listened to how they communicated with each other, how they related to each other, and I mimicked it a little bit.
But did you ever feel you were compromising who you were? Coming from Hunter's Point, the way you started to speak differently, did your friends tease you about
speaking? They did tease me. Even my mom teased me, and my brothers and sisters. But I didn't feel like I was compromising myself because I always dreamed beyond my circumstances. And now I'm seeing, this is another side of life that I never knew about. So this is going to help me get beyond my circumstances. And I was 8.
Wow.
I'll never forget my mom's, she's going to kill me for saying this. I never forget when I was a kid, and my mom said, someone called us on Christmas. And my mom said, girl, we had Christmas like white folk. And right then I knew I was not going to be less than successful.
Mm.
Yeah, I couldn't. Yeah.
You got an incredible story,
yeah.
in terms of how you actually got into radio. I want to touch on that for a moment because I think it's important for the listener to fully appreciate your journey. Before you ended up on the East Coast, you're in California, and you had this dream. You'd already rehearsed in your head from 11 years old what you're going to be, and the opportunity presented itself. Take us back.
Well, when I was, like I said, 11 is when it all, you know, kicked in. And I remember doing Christmas and all different holidays. That's when the communication skills kicked in. Before you walked in the door, as soon as the door opened during the holidays, I would introduce you. Right? Here come Aunt Billy, and I describe what you have on, the perfume you have on. She's wearing Charlie. She bought M&M's for all the kids. Everything I knew about a relative, I would always describe it. If you walked in the door and I didn't do that, they would be upset, go back outside, and say, you got to introduce me. Oh, yeah, it was a big thing. It was a big thing. And so I would introduce all of the celebrities that in my head I would impersonate, and then I would be the, I would, you know, perform. I was like, ladies and gentlemen, get up for the Jackson 5. So I would do the Jackson 5. I would do Prince. I would do all of this stuff. And I was mimicking Dick Clark and Don Cornelius. And I used to love this song called Disco Duck. And because I've always been silly. And it was, you know, Disco Duck song back in the 70s. And I love that song, man, because it was silly. And one day I was sitting back watching TV. And I remember the guy said, the TV show host said, when we come back, you're going to meet Mr. Disco Duck. And I'm like, no way. So I'm sitting there glued to the TV, right? And here he comes, Rick Dees. He walks out there and he's talking to Rick Dees. And he was like, yeah, I'm a radio DJ in Los Angeles, California. And right there, that was it. I said, that's what I'm going to do.
Wow.
That's it. I'm going to be on that radio.
Which of your family members, if any, saw what you were doing, was like, this could be special?
My brother saw it in my mid-teens, like right at 13, 14. I know just before I went into high school, my brother saw it. Because I used to have a Mr. Microphone, right? And I worked that thing, dog, right? I used to work that Mr. Microphone. And I got rid of it because I had a girlfriend young. And I had her on the Mr. Microphone. I put the Mr. Microphone to the telephone so my friends can hear her saying she liked me. Right? And I said, I told you she liked me, right? And she heard it squeal, you know, that feedback, that she was like, what are you doing? And hung up in my face. And I was embarrassed, right?
Wow.
So I was right there, I was mad at the Mr. Microphone. So one day, my brother came home and said, man, enough of this stuff. You about to step your game up. And bought me this Akai, which back then, that was the top-notch stereo. Bought me the new stereo, the microphone, and then that's when I started learning the DJ and really appreciating the sound of my voice, right? Because I guess the word I'm looking for is when you, step your game up, right? You continue to step your game up. Like if you buy a Bentley, you can't live in the same house. You got to have a garage for that Bentley to fit in.
Sure.
You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
Then you have to wear Bentley clothes. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
So when I heard my voice and I learned to appreciate my voice, I learned to appreciate how to deliver. I wanted to sound right.
I see.
Right? I wanted to move people. And it was this cat named Dr. Funk. He was the DJ. So I had Rick Dees. And then I saw Dr. Funk. He was a nightclub DJ. And I liked the way he moved people. It was like Oprah, man, like Michael Jackson. When people walked into a Dr. Funk party, it was like when they saw him, because it took forever to see him because everybody was crowded around him, Miguel Fonseca. And, man, when you saw Dr. Funk, it was like you was looking at Michael Jackson. I wanted to know what that felt like, man. You know, I just was like, this is crazy, right? And he would be in my neighborhood and come do little parties and stuff, man. And he'd drop a song and the crowd never even heard it. But it's the way he dropped it. It's the energy he had. It's the whole vibe, right? And he communicated through his music, through hits and things like that. So I learned all different phases of communication throughout my life. And so it's those things that I grew up with that made me appreciate great communication skills, how to deal with people, how to look at somebody's eyes and see if if we're connected.
Yeah, I'm with you.
You know,
I want to go back because what's fascinating for me is this: you have, if we look at this as sort of chapters, yeah. The first chapter is sort of playing it out in your head.
Yeah.
Stepping it up in terms of fully embracing the fact that I've got this thing. I know I didn't connect with people, but now I need to project my voice. I need to project exactly. my energy. And this specific DJ, you saw his, it wasn't just his voice. He was communicating his entire self.
Oh, man, he was.
His entire self. Yeah. One of the things that we know from radio DJs is that what's coming through the mic is your entire self.
Yes.
It's not just your voice. This is something you taught me, that if I smile even, people will be able to...
That's right.
So this is something I've noticed from you as well. You bring your entire self to a conversation, whether it's a kid, whether it's a homeless person, whether it's a celebrity. Being consistent like that, at what point, because when you got on radio, you didn't know this stuff.
Mm-mm.
Right? Because your story about radio, when you found yourself interning or just kind of hanging out at the station in California?
Well, how I got into radio was my big break. I went to broadcast school, first of all. And my first connection to radio, I got a job doing traffic, you know, reading what's going on in the highways and, you know, giving people traffic reports. And then my big break came when in radio, some guy, my story is crazy. The book is coming.
Mm.
It was a black guy in either Tracy or Stockton, California, got hung, right? Something happened with the Klan or something like that, killed him. And it was a position open at a radio station because of it. Oh. And I went for that position. Isn't that crazy? 2.5 hours away. And I still wanted that gig.
Where did you see it? In the news? What happened? You said
it was in the news.
Okay.
And then I found out that where he lived, a radio position came open in that area. And I was like, well, they ain't going to stop me. Right. So I sent the guy my air check tape, meaning my resume. So
yeah, like a demo.
Demo. And he just kept bothering me about a picture. Because when I first started doing radio, I tried to sound like this and like that. And, you know, I have the personality, but I didn't have my identity yet.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I tried to sound like this kind of guy. And so he wouldn't, he was like, send me a picture. I'm like, what you need my picture for? I knew why he wanted my picture. And I was like, dude, why are you concerned about my picture and me being black when you're black? And why should it even matter? Mm. You're a brother in the same city that I shouldn't be going to, right? So I would never, ever send that picture. So he decided, all right, fine, I'll meet you. So I drive to Stockton, California. It's KSTN radio.
2 hours away.
Yeah. I get there, and I had a car that if you go over 40 miles per hour, it shook the whole time. It was thundering and lightning, all that. I didn't know none of that was wrong. I had to get to that station.
Wow.
And so I get there, and he was looking at me like, huh. I figured you were black, and I'm like, well, I thought you were white. I mean, I thought you were black. He was a white guy. He thought I was a black.
Oh, wow.
Okay, he was a white guy. I thought he was black. I'm a black guy. He thought I was white.
That's crazy.
Right. And so, so I had to learn that language. I had to learn about agriculture because I had to read this agriculture report, which I never heard of agriculture. I'm a hood dude.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Couldn't even pronounce it back then.
Mm.
And I had to read it at 3 o'clock in the morning every night, and I messed it up so bad. This one dude called up and was laughing. He said, what?
Who in is this guy?
Right? And I was like, and it messed my whole night up. It messed my whole shift because I was embarrassed, dude. It was horses and cows. It was on a farm. Mm. And all I knew is I was on the radio, dude. That was it.
Wow.
And so I wanted, my dream was to work at the station, KSOL, which was, you know, the biggest station in San Francisco. That was my dream. And I found out that they were hosting a comedy competition. So I decided, let me try comedy. Right?
Get close.
Yeah, because I'll tell you this story real quick. When I was in broadcast school, I don't know if I ever shared this story with you. When I was in broadcast school, my fellow students were like, dude, you're pretty funny. You should try stand-up. I'm like, nah. It's like, you can be like Eddie Murphy. I'm like, nah. So one of the cats said, tell you what, I know of an open mic. We all just go down there and get drunk. We know you don't drink. And let's see what happens. All right, fine. So it was open mic. I did it. Killed it, right? Because I'm silly as heck. Killed it again. Because it was a bunch of people I knew. So I was wilding out. Mm. The manager said, you know, come on a Monday night when most of the big heavy hitters are here. If you can hold your own, we'll start paying you. You're funny, man. So I'm like, cool. So I came. Heavy hitters were there. Local cats. Mm. You know, so I came. And then I started getting paid, and he really dug me. He said, tell you what, this Saturday night, I want you to come. Whoopi Goldberg might be in town. He said, because somebody always shows up and understands she's in town. So a big name will show up.
Okay.
I'm like, all right, that's cool. So I'm looking forward to it. Did I ever tell you the story?
No.
Oh, my God. So my whole family, my friends, everybody was there. And they were like, man, you about to kill us. I said, yeah, I'm about to do my Don Cornelius joke and all the Mr. T joke, hey, fool, and all that. So I was up next. Right? I wasn't nervous, dude. I was about to kill it, man. I was good.
You're getting paid.
Yeah. And I was good. I was good.
Yeah.
So I'm about to go on stage. And this guy walks in the door, and he put a hoodie over his head. And he just started walking slow, kind of wobbling side to side. And the MC, Jeremy Kramer, I'll never forget, he said, oh my gosh, it's my Uncle Carl. It's my Uncle, ladies and gentlemen, Uncle Carl. And he just yelled, and nobody could see the guy because he had his, had his head down. And he didn't go backstage. He just came in, walked up the aisle. He gets on stage, turns around, takes his hoodie off. It's Robin Williams.
What?
Yeah. And so, and that's when Robin was.
Robin Williams.
Yeah, dude. Robin killed it, ad-lib, for 45 minutes to an hour. Had everybody, including me, under the table, drinks falling off. I mean, killing people. And remember, I said, I was next. So Jeremy Kramer said, Robin Williams, everybody, oh my God! And I was That's how my introduction was.
Wow.
And I'm standing there like an idiot. And I don't know how young your audience is, but Robin Williams used to be in a show called Mork and Mindy.
Yeah.
And he used to do this thing called Nanu Nanu, right? Mm. And that's the first thing I said when I walked on stage, dude. I said, Nanu Nanu. Crickets. So I got mad and embarrassed. I looked at this bald head dude. That's when Gandhi was hot. Right? I said, what you looking at, Gandhi? Crickets.
Oh, wow.
My best friend Jackie said, Smoke, my neighborhood name, my good name is Smoke. She said, Smoke, have you ever been embarrassed for somebody? Oh, my God. Oh, have you ever been? Right. My mother said, baby, you were good, but next time just be funny. So that, you know, doing comedy was out. I was tarnished and tainted.
Got it.
Then I found out, fast forwarding, KSOL was doing Black Comedy Competition, which is how Def Comedy Jam and all that started, with the Oakland Black Comedy Competition. Lionel B. and Kyle Newport. Oh,
that's how I got started.
Oh, yeah, man. Okay. Errol, you know, all those cats, man, they started all that. You know, Marcus King, and that's when Mark Curry, Jamie Foxx, Martin, all of them got the Robin Harris, all of them got their big break from that. Okay. Yeah. And so I was like, you know, what the heck? Let me go try this so I can get backstage and meet the cats from KSOL. Mm. Now, when I graduated from broadcast school in 84, I was calling KSOL for 4 straight years. They would never return my phone call. And I was the hottest club DJ around, bruh. I go there, and somehow I kept advancing in this comedy competition, right? And I got to know some of the people at the radio station. And so that's kind of how I got kind of in with them, and they knew my name, and I told them I want to intern. I've been calling you. Saw the program director, said, man, I've been calling you. He said, man, well, stay in touch, brother, and blah, 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 all of that. And so in 1989, it was the big earthquake in San Francisco.
Okay.
And I get a phone call about 2 days or a day or two later. And No. I'm sorry. Oh, my gosh. Okay. So my fiance at the time, I told her, I said, you know, I'm probably one of the biggest club DJs around, but this is not where I love Dr. Funk, but I always wanted to be on radio. Mm. She said, well, call Cancel Out. I say, I've been calling them for 4 years, man. They haven't returned. 5 years at that point. It was 89. They haven't returned my calls at all. She said, pick up the phone and call. What do you have to lose? So I picked up the phone. I made the call. India, who was the receptionist, answered the phone. KSOL. I said, hey, it's Bernie Moody. And she said, is this Menard Brown? Dude, remember, recognize my voice.
Wow. And no one in return calls or nothing.
None. Because wow. I blew him up.
Yeah.
And she said, Bernie was expecting your call. Hold on. Put me right through. He said, hey, man, what's happening, brother? He said, boy, I love your sticking to in this, man. You still want to work with us, man? I was like, heck yeah. He said, come see me tomorrow. And I walked in the KSOL, well, I'm touching walls, because I couldn't believe I was in that building, bro. And so he said, you know, come in Monday night, and you're going to get hooked up with, I won't say her name, and she's going to train you on the board. I'm like, cool. So I get into the studio. Okay, dude, I watch the DJs come on stage and, you know, introduce people. I'm about to cry when I love radio.
Yeah.
And I'm about to cry when I saw Marvin Robinson, Marvin.
And these are big
Lee Perkins. And yeah, well, Lee Perkins. I mean, he's, you know, Marcos Gutierrez, Isaac Stevenson. These are cats that I love these dudes, right? So I'm in this room with them, Billy Ocean and these guys. So I'm in the office where they hung out, so I'm freaking out. So that Monday came, I show up, hit the buzzer, she lets me in. I said, I'm Menard Brown, you're supposed to, you know, show me how to work the board. She says, is that what they told you? I'm like, well, yeah. They told me you was going to, you know, show me how to do the board. She said, no, I'm 8 months pregnant, either 9 months when I'm pregnant, and they ask you to come here. If we have another earthquake, I can get out, and then you can run the board. So they show, I was just hired so she can get out. And in case earthquake came, I can run the board and die.
Wow.
And I said, okay. You got it. She said, so get the hell out of here. That's why I don't say her name. She said, so you can get the hell out of the studio and go do something. Because I don't need you here. So I went running around looking, like, just looking at the pictures of all the
people. Because you're in the building.
I'm in the building.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And that's how I got started, man. And the rest kind of, you know, took off from there. And,
in the building.
I was in the building, bro.
And this is the moment where, you know, it all started to come together because you knew that I'm in the building.
Oh, yeah.
From the time when you were in your head a kid. You know, what's interesting is that, so you finally make it onto radio and you make a big leap and you end up on the East Coast in Florida.
Yeah.
Communicating with people in California versus Florida is a massive difference, or is it?
I'm going to tell you, one of the things, the reason why I was excited that I was in the building, let me see if I can make this scenario work. I was telling my son, he plays basketball, and he tried to learn all the crossover moves and all that when he was a kid. And I said, dude, learn the basics. Because with that crossover move, once you shake the guy off you, if you don't know how to get to the hole, you waste your time.
Yeah.
Right?
You got to score.
Everything's the basics.
Got it.
I knew once I got in that building, I can sell myself. Because I knew I can communicate with someone that from 1 year's old to homeless to everyday working man to a guy that ran a radio station. Communication is the same. The most important part is sincerity.
But what was giving you that confidence? Was it how much did being on stage and laughter? Recently I did a show about the power of laughter in terms of how it brings people together.
Right.
Was that part of it, or was it just this innate spiritual sense?
I just really believed that. I believed in myself, and I knew that radio was for me. And I knew that I would sell my story.
Yeah, but you can't just say that. Like, you come from a tough neighborhood. You've had all these experiences growing up. Where does this belief come from?
Seeing it, dude. When you see your dream and you touch your dream, it ain't no going back.
So it is spiritual. You see it in your head.
Spiritual, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's no going back. When I touched that brush and it became a microphone, it was no going back, Tim. It was going to happen, right? Because I saw that thing so vividly, you know? I heard people yelling my name on stage, dude. When the radio station came in my neighborhood and played charity basketball games, I was like, I'm going to be out there as one of them celebrities. I would be at a movie, and the DJ sit behind me, and I knew who he was. I'm like, that's Tony Kilbert. I freaked out, and I knew I was going to be that guy. Something as small as I went to a radio station, and Dan Shannon worked at KRE and KBLX. He came out and handed receptionists a winner sheet. You know, if you call a radio station and you win a prize, you know, the announcers have to fill out the sheet and you bring it to the front desk. It's different now. Everything is about computers. But back then, he brought it to the front desk. And I thought, I got to do that one day. I've got to have on jeans like that. Nice pair of shoes. Wow. And a nice shirt and be clean. Because radio personalities back then were classy. Mm. When you heard them, you wanted to. You had in your mind what they looked like.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you.
You know, they were intelligent. They talked about community respected and counted on.
They were voices of the community. Yeah, yeah, they weren't just radio presenters.
And when I saw Dan Shannon, he looked just like I thought. And I thought, I got to have on a nice pair of jeans like that one day, and I got to come out. And, you know, and when someone see me, they have to have that same respect. So when I got in that building, I knew when I talked to Bernie, or whoever it would be, I knew I would be able to communicate my dream. Because, you know, you can have a dream, but it's nothing if you can't communicate that dream.
You didn't grow up going to church and stuff. You know, there are people listening to this from all faiths, all backgrounds. I want to just, before I go to you going to Florida and being able to communicate with people who are vastly different mm-hmm. from how you grew up, where were you getting this faith from? The reason I'm pressing you on this, because this is the beginning of the year. People are listening to this going, I want to be able to put my best self forward. And I get all this deep stuff you're talking about, and live your dream and all that stuff in the brush. But where do you get the spiritual confidence from back then?
13. I was 13 years old. And I'm glad you asked that, dude. I was 13 years old. And I won't say the church, but the pastor had messed around a little bit on his wife. And he said, I'm sorry, y'all. Messed around on my wife. And no big deal. I mean, you know, we forgave him. No big deal. Mm. Months later, he didn't say that, but you give him a point. So it was like, and they forgave him again. Okay. Right? Didn't forgive nobody else in church. Mm. Anybody else holds and but Pat's just a man. That started bothering me. I was 13. And third time, he came up, had that old look, you know, that look. I did it again. And everybody's like, that's it, we done with you, partner.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone I knew in church was so full of themselves. It was so phony, man. It was all about money, who you know, and cliquish. And it just turned me off. And at the time, everything wasn't cool in the crib. I don't want to put my family out there like that. But everything wasn't cool in the crib. And I knew that I was a product of my environment. So I said to God, I don't want to know nothing about you through no books and through no people. I'm done. I'm done.
13,
bro. And that's a true story. I was in my mother's living room. I said, I don't want to know nothing about you. Teach me who you are on your own. That was it. And God has been in my life guiding me since. Where I blew it is when I got older. And I started going to church regularly. And I started being accountable to what they told me I should be doing. And forgot what God told me.
Do you think that lowered your beliefs and values accounting to people?
It did.
And it lowered your standard almost.
Yeah. It lowered my faith.
It lowered your faith.
It took my faith straight away. Because it became more in, I got to start tithing up. Or otherwise, I need to start going to church more. Otherwise, what he said in Ezekiel 44. Ooh, I got to, you know, I forgot that I asked God, you show me.
Straight from the source.
And the source got me to where I am. The source got me from the hood into being the baddest dude in radio everywhere I went. Right? That's where the source got me. How does that happen? You see what I'm saying? Mm. And the sources got me through being evicted to, you know, saving my crib, getting me into transportation I had no business being in. The source got me into nightclubs that there's no way I should have been DJing at these nightclubs. I was the dudes I admired came to my club trying to get my job. Mm. In 1989, late, I was on that stage, and people were saying, aren't you the dude from KSOL?
Wow.
I was the dude at the movies.
You became that guy.
I was that guy.
And you believe it came from when you were 13.
13.
And it helped elevate you there.
That's
and
right.
At some point, you started to lower.
Yeah. Dude, I had a faith that was unshakable, dude. I mean, and I'll never forget, it was like, I was 23 years old, and I was laying in my bed, and this has nothing to do with, I'm not an endorser of anything. I just believe your experience is okay to share. And I was like sinking as though I was going into hell, and I was burning. My skin, it wasn't a dream, and my skin was burning, and then I couldn't move my arms. And I'm thinking, well, I haven't done anything that's hell worthy, man. What's up with this? Mm. And I couldn't move. And then the first thing I thought, I said, well, I know if I called out Jesus' name, boom, I was released.
Immediately.
I didn't get a chance to finish my statement.
Wow.
And my 38-year-old son, he was, I don't know, six or something at the time. He said, Dad, why do you always have to get up in the nighttime? Because like 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and I had to be to work early in the morning. On the morning show, doing traffic. And so God has always been clear who God was. God never shared with me that I'm a man, or I'm a woman, or anything like that. God has always been this beautiful spirit and was always right on time, no matter what. I knew what my situation was. I was going to be delivered. I knew it every time. Every time I went through anything, I would say, I've been here before. Boom, God delivered me. Until I started going to church.
Do you feel like that your communication skills come from starting so early to communicate with God?
Yes. Because that's all I have to do.
And seeking the God in people.
Yes.
Now, this is where this conversation for me gets interesting.
Yes.
Is that what I've seen and observed with you, whether you were... whoever we were engaging, whether it was a waitress at a restaurant,
right,
you looked at them like there was a light in them, like you were trying to bring out their God in them.
Right.
Is that what you...
That's my thing, dude. That's why I do what I do. That's why I love conversation. Because if I can get a conversation with you, you're going to know you're somebody. That hopelessness is going to be gone. You're going to feel amazing because every single one of us are. Because, see, I never felt that way as a child. And when you met me, I hadn't quite believed that I was everything that I was encouraging everyone else to feel they were. And I never forgot that when I would go on the air most days, 99% of the time, I would hit the mic and I would say, there's no way I'm going to allow someone to feel the way I'm feeling. And that's when the communications, you know, it got better and better. And I could look at you and tell what you were feeling because I was feeling it. I was a magnet to people who needed what I had. Yeah, I was a magnet. And sometimes, you know, the greatest communication skill, like I said earlier, is the ability to listen.
Yeah.
I would meet people. Think about it. When you heard my radio show, here in North Carolina, Buster Brown is a legend in radio. Nobody would ever be another Buster Brown. But think about what people say about Buster Brown. And I tell other DJs this, and I don't know if they catch it. Whenever you talk about one of my greatest moments on radio, remember that time you were talking to that lady, and remember that time you had that little boy, and he said, remember that time you were talking to that dude, and it was always me and someone I was conversation and communicating.
Wow.
It was rarely a lone type of thing.
Yeah, right.
And I'm best when I'm talking and engaging with people. I am like a monster with that. I do that best. You know, I can do I'm great at motivational speaking, but when I'm engaging with someone, man, I'm on top of my
game.
You
shine. I remember one of my favorite moments. There's a few that really stand out, but I remember the conversation you had with Solange Knowles. This is before Solange
even
was deep.
When she said she didn't want to be Beyonce's sister.
Yeah. She said to you on air, you was like, please welcome Beyonce's sister Solange. And she's like, let me check you for a moment. And you're like, and you were like, you would not be on the show if you were not Beyonce.
I was a trip back then.
But you humbled her. And you guys end up having a brilliant conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an amazing moment for me because you weren't trying to destroy her. You were speaking to her truth. Yeah. This is who you are. And something tells me, she went back in her life and she decided, let me find my own voice so people will stop this. Lastly, you know, you had a conversation.
Let me say, I had that same situation with Beyonce. Before everyone knew she and Jay-Z, before it was official that they were dating, it was always they would always not confirm it.
No. They went there forever. They just
And I was interviewing Beyonce, and I said, I know a lot of people are afraid to ask you, you know, little radio people like me, if you and Jay-Z are dating. That's the rumor. She said, oh, then we just good friends. I said, well, let me ask you this, B. If you saw Jay-Z on a date, booed up with another woman, wouldn't bother you one bit. She got real quiet. I said to them, let me ask you this. If he saw you and me out on a date, chilling, would he trip? You're crazy. She said, you're so funny. Like that. I said, all right, you answered my question. Right.
And moved on.
And she said, you want to come backstage and hang out? Yeah. That, I mean, whenever, I'm telling you, I was told, you have 3 minutes with Cicely Tyson. 3 minutes. That's it. And Cicely Tyson came on the air. And if she hears this, she'll remember. She said, I have 3 minutes, young man, and that's all I have. So let's make this quick and make this short. And the first thing I thought about, and you know I'm not a bragging person. I don't have that kind of thing. I'm just sharing the power of communication and how doing what I did taught me how to. And she was over the phone. Right? And I said, oh, really? I said, I guess you really don't know me. I'm going to get 30 minutes out of you just for that. Right? So the first thing I said is, I said, can I share something with you? And I probably shouldn't because I think I'm going to lose a lot of listeners because I'm going to lose a lot of respect. But I have to get this out, Ms. Tyson. And people are going to say, I cannot believe he disrespected Cicely Tyson like that. And I set it up like that because I knew everybody would be sitting there, what is he going to say? I said, Bustin' Loose, the movie with Richard Pryor, I was so embarrassed that I had a crush on Cicely Tyson. And I was so embarrassed because are you supposed to feel like that about Cicely, Miss Jane Pittman?
Is
that disrespectful? She said, no, it is not disrespectful. I said, I'm thinking, she is so beautiful. And I'm looking at Richard Pryor, I'm mad at him the whole movie, hoping you never kissed. Right? And about 45 minutes later, we were off the phone.
Wow.
Right? Because you have to understand who you're talking to.
But let's go to the core of that, what you did.
Right.
So by understanding who you were talking to, you were able to get rid of this sort of stiff, you've got 3 minutes, young man, thing. But specifically, what was it? Give the listeners that tool, that thing that you did.
The tool is you have to know who you're talking to.
Okay.
Respect who you're talking to, and it's not about you. Anytime you have a conversation with an agenda, you're going to lose. If the agenda is not that person feeling good and feeling special, you will lose.
Wow.
Right.
The agenda is that person feeling amazing.
Amazing.
Special.
Amazing.
And then they're going to light up, and everything they thought is going to go away.
Go away. And when you listen, you can't listen with an agenda. So when I said that, I listened whatever she said I was going to accept. I wasn't listening, my next thing, Harriet was Tyson, because I got something else I'm going to say. I was listening, like, if this is not going to be the thing that connects us, I'm cool with that. And let me go and get off this phone. But I knew that would be the thing, and I believe that she would have appreciated a compliment like that from a young man.
Wow.
Yeah. And so you have to know who you're talking to, and you have to go into a conversation without an agenda, because the purpose of great communication is not about you, it's about the other person. And if you communicate what they need, you'll get that back. You don't have to worry about it.
You have to take us quickly to, as we sort of close this part, because we've run out of time.
Yeah.
But your conversation with Stevie Wonder, who happened to be one of your idols.
Yeah.
Stevie Wonder was
one of?
Yeah, your idol.
The.
He's in town, and most people would know these sort of press junkets where, you know, you go around the radio station and, you know,
right. You
guys get a few minutes with Stevie Wonder.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Just take us through this.
Okay, quickly. The young lady who ran the radio station at the time when I was at this station, she was, she was a sweetie pie to do what she did. Shalene Cole. At a WQMG. I was leaving out the building. She said, hey, be here tomorrow at 1. Are you busy? I said, nah, I'll be here. What's up? She said, you can interview Stevie Wonder. I'm like, whatever, man. Because everybody knows. Mm. She knew.
She
ran the station. She could have had that interview. But she thought, there's no way I'm going to take this from him. And she said, be here. And she ran everything down. He'll call in. And I gave him the hotline number, which is the direct number to the radio station. So he calls the Oprah Winfrey thing you explained. Stevie will be calling in, blah, blah, mm-hmm. right? And I'm sitting there sweating. I'm like the lady. I almost fainted.
Yeah.
And she conferenced him in, and I heard his voice, not on TV, not on a record. I heard his voice. Buster, what's up, son? Because they told him.
Yeah, yeah, and he's been doing this
forever. That's what he's been doing
it
forever. And he knows how to make
engaged.
He knows communication.
Wow.
What's up, son? And I'm like, this is crazy. Am I about to really talk to Stevie Wonder? And immediately I thought, you can't do this because you're robbing your audience. They want Busta Brown to interview Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
They want that conversation. Mm-hmm. They want one of their favorite communicators.
Not the fan interviewing.
And I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
So I talked to Stevie. But one of the things we did is we had a conversation about Stevie. I said, dude, in 1979, why would you tell Barbara Walters that you'd be dead in 81? He said, you remember that? I said, dude, I'm probably your biggest fan ever. And I talked to him about things... Real Stevie.
Beyond just the music.
Man, I'm telling you. We didn't even talk about music.
Okay.
The only thing we talked about as far as music is I asked him if I can play back questions from my listeners. Because I had my listeners call in and get their questions. I wanted their voices to be heard talking to Stevie. Right? Because you don't share. You don't have Stevie to yourself. You got to share him.
Wow.
There's probably a million people listening at that time. This is their show. And so the only thing that came about music was, she said, for you to be blind, you write music more beautiful than people that can see.
Can see, yeah.
How is that possible? Mm. He said, because I do dream like everybody else. And I can see in my dream. Right. It was awesome. So we talked about like everything from his childhood and everything I knew about Stevie. I shared with Stevie.
And how much time did you have with him?
Well, we had 10 minutes. But what happened is, I don't think Stevie would mind me saying this. The lady clicked in and said, "Mr. Brown, your time is up." He said, "Hold on for a second, Buster." I heard him go click, 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 and he came back and he said, "All right, just me and you. Let's go, baby." And I'm like, "No way." And I talked to Stevie Wonder for an hour and a half. And I edited it up to where it seemed like I was talking to him from 3 to 7. So then he had the young lady call me back and said, "I want to meet." She said, "Stevie wants to meet you." Right. I'm like, "Don't." I said, "Don't do that. Please don't do that." Right. Because I've been in the business a while, and people say they want to meet you just because they want you to promote
your
stuff.
Yeah, they don't even do it.
And she said, "No, he wants to meet you. How many people are you bringing with you?" So I'm like, "You got to be kidding me." And I just wasn't ready for that. So I get backstage, And she says, Stevie, Buster's here. Stevie jumped up and said, Buster, where my boy at? Right. It was the craziest thing. So I wrap it up. So he said, we talked and hugged and about to cry. And my co-host said, she was crying. I'm like, what are you crying about? She said, the person you wanted to meet the most wanted to meet you.
Mm.
She said, that's amazing. And he said, the interview, can you burn that for me? I want to listen to it while I'm on tour. And I'm like, you got to be kidding. I said, well, I don't. How am I getting it to you? He said, bring it tomorrow night. I said, I don't have tickets for the Raleigh show. He said, dude, I got you. And I'm like, oh, well, hmm. Because you know me, I'm about family.
Big time.
I say, dude, can I bring my son and grandson, please? Come on, man. They love you, too. He said, bring them. And he let me bring them. And we've just been partners ever since. My kids played the piano with Stevie. And we've been friends ever since, man. And one of the things he said, he don't like it when he allowed people to video stuff and then put it all on. And it's supposed to be a personal, yeah, intimate thing. I've never put any of the videos with Stevie and my children on YouTube, and I won't, out of respect for Stevie Wonder. I'll never do it, because I'll never forget that it mattered to him. And the last thing I'll say is, we hit it off, but nothing ever really developed, and, you know, and about a week later, phone ring, it was a 310 area code. I knew that was L.A.
Yeah.
I said, there's no way. And I answered the phone, Boston, what's up, boy? I'm like,
Stevie.
And it was Stevie. He just called the chat. And we're talking about Obama, because this was 07 or 08. We're talking about Obama. Just talking about life. And he was working on the speech and, you know, for something he was doing. And, man, Stevie is the funniest. He likes to have fun more than the stuff that I think people approach him with. Like, when I interviewed him, I was real silly and funny with him. And I think that's how we connected. And I'll never forget LaTanya, who was his publicist. She said, you understand Stevie met dignitaries and kings and queens, and he wanted to meet you. He saw something special about you. So just know that. And ever since, we've been pretty cool. And,
wow.
Yeah, that was amazing, right?
Listen,
the power of communication, man.
There's no other way to close this interview except to ask you, give me 1 minute of what you want your sons to know. I know how important they are to you. You want them to know about communication and your grandson.
The main thing I want them to know, and what I work on them with, is how to communicate your dream and how to communicate to others the importance of world peace.
Wow.
That's it. That's important. Yeah.
Menard Brown, thanks for joining
us. Thanks, Tim.
On the Brain
Appreciate
and Brand
you.
Show.
Love you, boy.
Love you too, man. Thank you. You know, this whole Oprah thing, it's not even relevant after this conversation. All I'll say is that, you know, what I did with Oprah is stuff that I learned from you, which was, I didn't act like I was a big fan. I listened to her energy and her moment, and I said to Oprah that, you know, one day you're going to write for it in my book, because I think we have something in common. She laughs and says, you don't know it, but I don't write forwards. Not even for Maya Angelou, because if people don't like me, they're not going to read your book. If they like me, they're going to read it unfavorably. So,
that was deep.
Yeah. And so she says,
absolutely correct.
Then she walked away, and then she came back, and she says, what is your book about? And then she started giving me advice about my book and just whatever. But it was about having a real conversation with her. Exactly what you said. So thank you for this show.
Yeah.
And thank you for listening and hanging out, guys. Thank you.
You met Oprah.
Thank you for hanging out. And, you know, continue to subscribe and tune in. I appreciate it. Please share your feedback. And if you want to know more about Menard, Buster Brown, I'm going to put all the details and show links up. But if they want to follow you on Twitter, What can they, or
in your Buster social media? Brown 63.
Buster Brown.
BustaBrown 63 on Facebook, Instagram, and BustaBTweet. That's so corny. On Twitter. And Oprah, I love you and I admire you. I just have to say that, because if she's listening, I love Oprah. She is a great communicator.
Yeah. She's a
genius. I love Oprah.
We'll be back next week with the next episode of the Brain and Brand Show.
This is CliffCentral.com.